the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hello, this is Nicole Martin, KBLU's sound artist in residency. I am personally inviting you to the Threshold Shift audio party happening Monday, November 6th from 6:30 to 8 o'clock p.m. at KBLU Studios on 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon. We'll be celebrating all things audio, including the wrap of the Threshold Shift Sound Artist in Residency project, where you'll have a chance to meet the artist as well as the folks at the KBLU Studios who helped make it possible. We're also going to launch the Portland chapter of the Listening Lounge, an informal audio collective of sound enthusiasts that meets monthly to have a potluck and share audio that catches our ears, maybe doesn't have a project that fits it yet, or could use a fresh listen. So feel free to bring friends, ideas, and your enthusiasm for sound. No experience necessary. For more information, you can visit the Threshold Shift program page at kbu.fm.
This is Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of Monopoly media manipulation and an examination of the news you're not supposed to know. Well, there's all kinds of news today, of course. And I noticed that the resident in the Oval Office is trying to make a big deal and pound his chest over the recent terror in New York. And, of course, he reacts in a fascist manner, wanting to send the man to Guantanamo because, you know, the justice system isn't horrifying enough, which is ridiculous. And if I were doing a topical news story today, I think I'd be talking about that quite a bit. But fortunately for us, I have a guest today, and if the wires are working, then I have Matt Taibbi on the line. And good morning. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. How are you?
I'm pretty good. Congratulations on the book. Is that a German publisher?
No, it's a division of Random House, actually.
Oh, okay. All right. I thought Matt Taibbi had to go to Germany to get published? No, okay. Good, then. All right. Well, thank you for joining me once again on the KBOO airwaves. I very much enjoyed talking to you about your book, Insane Clown President. And your new book is being very well received indeed. It seems to center on the tragic killing of Eric Garner, but you dug much farther than the immediate circumstances to show why this sort of thing happens. Tell me who Eric Garner was.
Eric Garner was a small-time dealer in untaxed cigarettes who had a past where he had been a crack dealer. He was the father of five. He was married. He had spent a lot of time in prison, was a great athlete in his youth, but had become, largely due to treatment from steroids for asthma, he had become obese and was in bad health. But he was a complicated, funny, interesting, flawed, complex individual, and one of the things I was trying to do with this book was to make him out to be something other than just a victim, which is what he was in the news.
The situation you describe, that of a black man with a felony conviction, leaves, frankly, no way to get ahead to support a family, which you say is what he was trying to do, short of some kind of smuggling or hustle. Can you describe his situation more?
Oh yeah, Eric had he had no real opportunities for employment, and some of that was his own fault. I mean, he did have He did participate in a program that the city created for people, for ex-convicts, but it only paid him something along the lines of $65 every 2 weeks. And while he was employed in that fashion, he was arrested for drug dealing. And so when he got out again, there was no way to get a square job at that point. And he tried doing odd jobs here and there, and it just didn't work out. And the whole thing about cigarettes happened because New York happens to have the most regressive and crazy consumption tax in America, with this tariff on cigarettes. So it allowed for people like Garner to create a business almost overnight by engaging in this arbitrage, where they would buy tax-free cigarettes in places like Virginia for $5 a pack and sell them for $9 in New York, where the in-store prices were more like $14.
Well, so he was trying to deal, and you say that he was trying to support his family.
Mm-hmm.
He had, what, 6 kids?
5, technically, yeah. I mean, yes. He had, it's complicated because when he was married, he married a woman who already had 2 children, and he adopted those children. So, but his natural children were, I think he had 5 natural children. And he was very devoted to his kids. He took a great deal of pride in being able to take care of his kids, and said frequently that he would do it from a jail cell if he had to. And with the cigarettes, he developed over the years a phobia of spending money on himself. So he wouldn't even buy himself new clothes. His clothes would literally fall off his body sometimes, but he kept his kids in brand name clothing, and he was just an interesting character that way.
What was Eric Garner doing on the day he was murdered?
Eric Garner was not feeling well that day. He had had been involved in sort of an altercation the night before. He came to the street that morning. It's a little park in Staten Island called Tompkinsville Park. And he came to it troubled and also feeling physically unwell. He talked to some people on the street. He went to a bathroom for a long while, and was in the bathroom for probably well over an hour. He came out of it, and right as he did, there was a fight in the park, and Eric broke up the fight because one of the things that he was trying to do constantly was keep the police away from the park. He called it keeping the block from getting hot, and then he...
So he was actually keeping the peace.
A little bit, yeah.
Even though he was suffering from diabetes and asthma.
Yeah, yeah, but he was a big man. He was, 6'3", 350 pounds, so when he told people to cool it, they did. And he broke up this fight, and then he leaned up against the wall to catch his breath, and that's when he's approached by the police.
Now, what was going on economically in that part of Staten Island at that time?
Staten Island, yes, yeah.
It seems like you've described gentrification going on.
Yeah, so that part of the island originally was kind of a ghetto, or it was a middle class neighborhood for a while, and then it became sort of abandoned. And I talked to a drug dealer who said, when I first came here, I wouldn't see a cop for 6 months. But then there was a new housing development that started along the water, not far away, just across the street, actually. It was a $1 billion project that involved multiple buildings, and now the police suddenly started arriving all the time because there was this tremendous pressure in the borough to make the real estate more valuable. So Eric Garner, had he been there 5 years before, 10 years before, this would never have happened. He probably would never even seen a police officer.
This is part of what I like about this book, is this shoe leather quality. And you're known for a much more brash style, generally speaking, and certainly an insane clown president. I enjoy that very much. Mm-hmm. And I'll get around to style and that sort of thing in a few minutes. But I like the fact that this effort that you have made to humanize Eric Garner. I mean, the overall impression I get from the parts of the book that I was able to read before I went on air was what this is really about is white supremacy.
Yeah, and segregation. I think that's a huge... These are two huge elements to what's going on here. In the cities, in the big cities, which are politically predominantly Democratic, the classic formula for a mayor who in turn controls the police department, and all policing is local, is a socially liberal mayor who is tough on crime. A classic example of that would be somebody like Martin O'Malley or Michael Bloomberg, right, who's for gay marriage, but, you know, he says he's very tough on crime. And a lot of white voters don't ask themselves what these candidates mean when they say things like that. What does tough on crime mean? What does community policing mean? Well, it turns out that it's a highly interventionist, aggressive policy that is designed to keep Black and Hispanic people from sort of wandering into white neighborhoods. The whole underlying problem of police brutality in the big cities, anyway, has a lot to do with this enormous number of contacts between police and the population that exists, because what cops are doing a lot is essentially border enforcement. They're sort of keeping neighborhoods separate. And it's an unspoken side to the story that is rarely commented upon.
I've really tried to wrap my head around what's going on in the minds of police. And there seems to be a group mentality which is different. It allows things that an individual mentality wouldn't allow. And it seems to me that police pick up on the desires of the society, even when they're not written down, when it comes to gentrification, when it comes to white supremacy, or even anti-gay, anti-GLBTQ sentiments. Do you think maybe Officer Pantaleo, the man who took down Eric Garner, do you think he and his cohorts were trying to clean up the streets for the new white residents? Is it, you know, part of that broken window suppressive policing that was going on? I mean, can you tell me from your understanding and from the videotape and your shoe leather work, what happened when the police arrived to confront Eric Garner?
Well, there's a couple of nuances here. One is that it's pretty clear from the police statements about what happened in the case that these two men, it was Pantaleo and another officer named D'Amico, they were dispatched to the park to, quote, address specific conditions because somebody, I think a lieutenant, had seen probably Eric Garner standing on the corner on the way into work. And this is very hard to explain, but it has to do with a statistics-based system that the police employ called ComStat. So what happens is these sort of mid-level managers in the police ranks, like lieutenants and captains, they have to go for these daily meetings where they get yelled at by their superiors in Manhattan. And what they do is they stand in front of these big projection screens, and they're shown pictures of the neighborhoods that they're supposed to be patrolling. And they say, you're doing fine here, but this neighborhood is still screwed up, and we want this block clean, we want that person off the block, et cetera, et cetera. And so what they do is they go back to the precinct, and they'll tell some of their people, hey, we want you to go out to block X, Y, and Z and clean it up. And Eric Garner probably was just seen by one of these lieutenants, and then these two guys are sent to the block to fix the problem, quote unquote. But you know, when I talked to police about this, they said you can't just tell the guy to move or go home, or take it someplace else. You got to get a number. You can show your boss that you did something. You got to arrest him. You got to get him in a squad car. And so that's why when you watch the video, you see this problem where they only feel like there's one option, right? They're only considering one option. The only option is to get him in the car. The rest of, and Garner won't go. So they resort to violence.
Let me interrupt you for a second there, because that caught my attention too. Garner wouldn't go, but he didn't. I mean, what he really did, and this certainly jives with my personal experience, what he really did was show some attitude. He didn't feel like being humiliated and taken down. Didn't he say something about he'd had enough? And it's that moment. It's like that. It's like certain, over and over again, we see that if you're black, particularly, if you're a black male, particularly, but maybe if you're a member of many of these other groups that just aren't, as you would say, in the mainstream, you can't afford that moment, that 1 second of defiance. Once you show defiance, then the blood flows. But now that I've interrupted you, please
right.
Go on with your narrative.
You're making a critical point. And actually, Eric Garner, his whole life had not been that person. He had been a person who saw the police as the price of doing business, and had always interacted with them in a way that was, I don't know how to put this in a way that's not going to sound strange, but it was almost businesslike. Essentially, it was, okay, you caught me, so the rule is I got to go sit in jail for X number of days, and I got to pay this fine, and then I'm back out in the street, and it's a game. You know, the game is the game, right? That's the way he looked at it.
Well, certainly Citibank understands that as they launder drug money.
Of course, and it's completely different for another kind of actor. But for Eric Garner, he never saw the police as anything but as a sort of mechanical annoyance that he had to deal with. What changed for him was when he felt like they were stepping outside the lines of the unwritten rules of how things work in the street to go after him. They stopped him on the way to the supermarket. They vouchered his money at a laundromat. They picked on him when he wasn't at work, and he even filed a complaint about this. And so this person who his entire life had been exactly the person who would have meekly gone into the car, on this one day after an accumulation of insults and humiliation, suddenly says, "This stops today. I'm not going." And so you're absolutely right. You know, I'm not saying that he was wrong to do it. I'm just pointing out that's the dynamic of what happened, is that these two meatheads who were sent there with only one thought in their heads, which was, we got to get this guy into a squad car, clashed with a person who had finally had enough. And that's what happened.
Now, of course, the grand jury process happened, and that was also shocking, but not surprising, I guess. And you point out that Officer Pantaleo's record wouldn't have been available, but that it was leaked. I wonder if someone on the police payroll is acting out of conscience. But the grand jury process, I mean, the way it's loaded for police, can you talk about that?
Sure. In New York, as in many cities, you can't get a felony indictment without a grand jury hearing the case first. And because there's so much crime in the city, they usually do it in a kind of factory-style fashion. You have a sitting grand jury, so you'll have a room full of 24 or 18 people or whatever it is, and they're sitting in the room, and prosecutors will kind of come in one after the other and present maybe 3, 4, 5 cases a day. If you have a stabbing, they'll bring in the weapon, they'll bring in one witness, and the prosecutor will say, basically, hey, this thing happened, trust us, we're going to take it to trial, we have enough evidence to, you know, make it at least a case, and an hour and a half later you get an indictment from the grand jury. That's how it usually works, and that's why the expression exists in New York that a prosecutor can get a grand jury to indict a ham sandwich. In this case, what they did is they convened a special grand jury that was not hearing other cases, that only heard this case, that didn't take just a couple of hours to consider the matter, but took months and months and weeks, and heard 50 witnesses.
All of whom would be selected by the prosecutor with the judge not present, no exclusion of hearsay, no screening for bias in the grand jury, just a very special now you're in the custody of the police system, and we're going to ask you, do you think we're bad? I mean, there's just, well, there's no way you can get an indictment.
Exactly, and this is what is so strange about the whole thing, is that the grand jury system in New York is designed to give prosecutors enormous power. It's designed to be a rubber stamping mechanism, so that when prosecutors go in, they have, as you say, they have the, you can't object to hearsay testimony. There's all kinds of rules that you can't do. The prosecutor has complete discretion over what the grand jury hears and doesn't hear. So if they want you indicted, they get you indicted. It's almost unheard of for grand juries not to indict. In this case, however, what it looks like from the outside, and I found a lot of other cases where this same pattern existed, you know, dozens of witnesses, months and months and months of testimony, and no indictment in the end. It looks like what they actually did is sort of put on a defense case instead of trying to get an indictment. And when prosecutors come out of the grand jury and they say, oh, geez, we didn't get an indictment, but you shouldn't be mad at me, you know, we did the best we could, that's a huge red flag, because prosecutors should be furious when they don't get an indictment, especially if they spent 3 months trying to get one. So the whole thing was very suspicious.
Well, and it's the sort of detail that the book brings out. It really humanizes Eric Garner. It really puts things into context. I think this sort of book is really valuable, and I encourage people to read it. I Can't Breathe by Matt Taibbi. Now, I want to change topics here. You have written an apology on Facebook. And before we get into this, I have an advantage over you. I don't want to be hypocritical here. I'm a transgender gal, and one of the ways I used to try to hide when I was closeted was to be brutally macho. I used to get around on a motorcycle in Lubbock, Texas. I used to sit with my friends at the University of Texas in Austin and, you know, talk women down. So I have an advantage over you, namely the jackassery I indulged in my youth. The crap came out of my mouth is deservedly obscure, but you were in print.
Right.
So you have apologized in print after being called out for the predatory sexism revealed in your writings for the Russian English language publication Exile. And you say you've changed. So I got to ask you about that. If so, what brought about that change? I mean, really shoving women under the table for oral sex? What do you have to say to young men who admired work like yours and Jim Goad's?
Well, okay, first of all, that was Mark writing that, not me. I did co-author a book that was full of all sorts of horrible language, and I, in other places, did indulge in a lot of misogynistic and over macho language, and I do feel bad about it. We had an idea that I think at one point may have been sincerely satirical, which was to try to send up the foreign aid community in Moscow, which we knew was preaching that it was helping by day, but was actually basically in Russia to make huge amounts of money and have sex with Russian women. And but we became the people we were satirizing pretty quickly. We thought we were sort of exposing a community, but we ended up celebrating it. And you know, I had a lot of regrets after that when I came home. That wasn't the only thing that I had done at the Exile. In fact, it was a fairly small part of what my job there was. I was kind of the straight man in a two-man act, where the outside of the paper was political and media writing, and the inside of the paper was all about the nightlife and what was going on, you know, sort of after dark. And my job was the daytime stuff. But I legitimized all of it, and I indulged in some of the writing too. And you know, I came home and the only thing I can say is I had kind of a come to Jesus moment about what kinds of things where I could make a contribution, what was valuable for me to say and what wasn't, and I went from there. I mean, I think if anybody who is familiar with my work dating back quite a long time now will see, you know, that an absence of certain themes in my work.
Well, no doubt. But I think that there's a really valuable moment happening right now when it comes to sexism, when it comes to equal treatment of women. We have this opportunity now that, I mean, you know, because so many stories are now coming out. And so I don't want that moment wasted. I don't want this shoved under the table, so to speak. I don't, you know, the reason I made my confession first is because, yeah, all of us who acted as males, and this says something, this would, another hour discussion about gender roles could come out now. We have all been in this, and now is the opportunity not to say it didn't happen or not to say that that was then, this is now sort of thing, but instead just to use this moment and to actually be honest and humble and sincere and turn it around. And I think that your comments on Facebook are a good start on that. But I want to ask you again, more pointedly, what would you say to young men who are taking that attitude right now, who's, you know, I would call it that National Lampoon, Jim Goad sort of attitude. What would you say to young men who admired work like that?
Well, I wouldn't say that National Lampoon and Jim Goad are in the same stratosphere.
Back 20 years and look at National Lampoon. You'll find plenty of that. 30 years. I'm old.
Okay. I mean, Jim Goad is extreme beyond words, and National Lampoon was you know, it was Sam Kinison, it was, you know, it was, you know, Animal House. I mean, yeah, it was bro humor, but it's not Answer Me, which is, you know, sort of the kind of publication that Ed Kemper would probably find funny. You know what I'm saying? I think it's unfair to put those two publications side by side. I don't see that comparison at all.
Okay, I'm going to do my work on this, and I think you'll be shocked.
Okay.
But as I was saying, I think that this is about this is the moment, because it's about power when it comes down to it. It's about the power of a male-dominated society, and that book 18 years ago, I've got to point this out, this is a long time ago, you had some power, and you both wrote about the power of a young, relatively well-connected American. I mean, your father was a reporter and a successful one, and you were in devastated post-Gorbachev Russia, and so that amplified things. I do think that there's this opportunity to take that and run with it, and to say that we who have acted as men, which is a funny thing for me to say, because I transitioned in 2001, and I've kept this voice, though, because I want to keep this. This is part of who I am. I keep this hermaphrodite quality, but I don't want to hide from the fact that, as I was saying, especially for me, trying to appear more macho than I could be, I couldn't actually ever feel it. So I would double down on that. This is not the moment to dodge that. This is the moment to seize that and say, let's move forward and let's create a new society, a different society in which we truly treat women equally. Do you have comments on that?
Well, I agree with all that. I don't, but the only way I know how to participate in that is to do the work that I do. I don't see that. I mean, the root of this whole problem, the way that I got in trouble in the first place, was trying to have opinions about things that I didn't really know a whole lot about and wasn't eloquent about. I've tried since I've come home, since you know, for 17 and 18 years now, well, more like 16 years, I guess, just to do work about things that matter, you know, talking about how Wall Street works, how the police work, and I think that that's a contribution that's valuable. I don't.
And you haven't. I think that is how you should be viewed. But I'm also saying, you know, you and I are not the ones that are hurt in this context.
Mm-hmm.
We're not the ones that suffer the pain of this. So I guess I won't leave it at that. And
No. Let's talk about it.
Okay.
I don't know what else to do except say, I said this yesterday in my post. I think apologies from writers are basically hollow. I mean, the way this business works is that if you're offensive and hurtful, you will not be read, and that's appropriate. You will lose readers, and the way that you apologize to readers is by not being that anymore, and by doing something that's more positive.
Thank you so much for joining me. I have completely run out of time. Thank you for being honest. And your book is historically significant. I think it should be read. I Can't Breathe by Matt Taibbi. Stay tuned, please, for Per Fagering, who is ready to come into the studio. Thanks again, Matt Taibbi.
Bye-bye.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to present David Barsamian, Resistance in the Age of Trump, on Sunday, November 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. Journalist, author, and activist David Barsamian will be speaking about the broad coalition in opposition to the Trump administration, which includes activists from a range of causes, progressive Democrats, and concerned Republicans. He'll be reflecting on the core issues at stake today and why so many people from such a range of identities and perspectives are challenging the administration. Again, that's KBOO Presents David Barsamian, Resistance in the Age of Trump, on Sunday, November 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information